Well, thanks for coming, everyone, on a sunny afternoon. So, when I conceived of this in the way back in the last term when we were organising the programme, I thought I'd be further ahead with it than I am. So, today it's going to be more of a seminar than perhaps a lecture by me, in the sense that I'm interested in it's a completely new project. I want to develop a new kind of a understanding of the history of the notion of the self, really, in the history of India. And I was going to offer a few preliminary thoughts, which I still will do today, but it's still very unformulated, and I haven't landed with it yet. So there's a background to. Oh, hi, come in. Oh, I was just saying that this is a beginning of a project which has yet to come to realization, and I'm not going to give you a formal lecture. I'll talk through a few points in the handout, but there's a background to this. Is that the 30 years ago there was a book edited by Michael Crothers and some others, Stephen. I'm just saying this is a beginning of a project that is yet to come to fruition. So it's going to be a seminar more than a lecture. So a few years ago, 30 years ago, there was a book called The Category of the Person, which was edited by Stephen Luke, Stephen Collins and Michael Carithers. And that was an important book because it was responding to Marcel Mauss's essay from the 1920s or 1930s on the category of the self. And he also argued that there was a history of the self and that China and India didn't quite get there. But he's gone off already. But the notion of the West did achieve the notion of a self, of an individual. This is Mauss's argument. And this book was responding to Mauss. So it was an interesting essay by Dearnick Allen, and there was to that essay. And in that book was Alexis Sanderson's first publication, Purity and Power Among the Brahmins of Kashmir, which in my view has changed our understanding of history of Indian religions. So that was published in 1985. But it's interesting that Sanderson is responding to Mauss. So all of this comes out of response to Mauss's essay. So I thought that was it'd be interesting to revisit that notion of the category of the person. What is the category of the person in the Indian context? Does it exist? Is there an analogue? I mean, we talk about the self, but what about the category person? I know there was a book not too long ago, Purusha, but often Purusha is just a placeholder for self, you know. So that was the first thing. The second, there's an interest in a broader context of metaphysical ideas about the self, and the relation of these categories to the notion of person and self to the wider understanding of society and sovereignty. So I was interested in kind of the developmental notion of a self in India, and the way it changes in relation to the ambient politics and society in which it's occurring, and to what extent we can reconstruct that, if we can. So that was another thing behind this project. What's the relation between metaphysical ideas and historical, social, political reality, if you like, and sovereignty? So we don't get, part of this also, we don't get a political philosophy or political theology of the person in India, it seems to me. We've got things like, there's no Thomas Hobbes in India. Now, why is that? And that's interesting. We've got Arthashastra, and so you've got to tease it out from these kinds of texts. And we need to other kinds of literature, like the Dharma literature and so on. So the social, historical, political context of the category of the person, we've got to tease out. There's no Thomas Hobbes, there's no political theology really develops within an Indian context, it seems to me. I might be wrong, but I think that is the case. And I'm hoping to look at that. And also how the category of the person fits into the wider society and culture. I mean, we often, I'm completely guilty of this, focus on text, but what about the wider other cultural products like literature, art, sculpture, other things that are going on. The category, the metaphysics doesn't occur in a vacuum, it occurs within a social context and artistic cultural context too. So I think it'd be interesting to look at the category of the person in relation to these other kinds of cultural productions. And also to indirectly respond to Morse's essay again in a new way in 30 years after that book. And a third thing I think was the way that the notion of the person is connected to the notion of a sacrifice and the sacrificial self. So last summer, or two years ago, we were in Nepal. We have a summer school every year in Kathmandu, and although not so much this year because it was a particular time of the month, but in previous years, sacrifices everywhere, sacrificing goats, buffaloes. I haven't seen any chickens, but buffalo, but goats in particular, to goddess, to ferocious goddesses. And also I've done work in Kerala, where they also sacrifice mostly chickens there to the Tayam deities. And in Bali, Pasha, who was here, he's gone now, but he was telling me about sacrifice in Bali as a normative kind of Hinduism. And I was thinking that Bali means sacrifice, or in Sanskrit, blood offering. And I was thinking that Bali, the country, might come from that. And someone said that they thought it might well do. And so I don't know. Someone said it would come from Balin, actually, a mythological figure. But Bali seems more likely to me. So you've got this sacrifice, which is normative Hinduism, what we call Hinduism, in these regions, Nepal, Kerala, Bali, perhaps Southeast Asia. And so this also linked up with a theory I read some years before, that the edges of cultures preserve something of their origins, preserve something older than the heart of the culture. So I can't remember the theorist, I can't find him for the life of me. But this person proposed that there were three layers of culture, call it A, B, and C. And A is the culture that changes historically through time due to its own momentum, as it were. B is the cultural influence outside of that. And C is the outer culture. Now, C changes because of its contact with the ambient civilizations and cultures around it. But B preserves an older version of A. B preserves an older version of the society. So I thought that was a very interesting idea. And I was thinking that we've got in Kerala, Bali, and Nepal, the outer regions of Brahmanical tradition preserve an older version of the tradition than occurred in the centre. And that's the third kind of impulse behind this, and this isn't what I want to talk about, but I think it's the background to it. You've got Vedic sacrificial tradition, and then you've got the Shramana tradition, like Buddhism, Jainism, and these other Ajivikas, the Kayatas. They react against that, and say, "Oh, that's all that violence, and that's." You've got to attain peace and the calming of the mind in order to free the self, to attain liberation. And then, so they reject the notion of sacrifice. And then the Mimamsakas defend the notion of sacrifice against the Shramana reaction, saying, no, it's not killing, it's a different category altogether. So you've got this toing and froing, you've got the Vedic sacrificial tradition carries on, defended philosophically by the Mimamsaka, which I want to talk a bit about today, against the Shramana renunciate tradition. And so that's behind this notion of, well, so what is this notion of a self that is entailed in these in the sacrificial worldview, which arguably was a central tradition up until about, say, 15th century. And then you get the demise of the tantric Hindu medieval kingdoms, the rise of the Delhi Sultanate, and then eventually the rise of the Mughal Empire. So goodbye Hindu tantric kingdoms, state-sponsored sacrifice, and the rise of a new kind of Hinduism, which emphasizes individual worship, which emphasizes a direct relationship with God. And then you've got Chaitanya, who's a contemporary of Luther, of course, born the same year, I think, and the whole movement that comes out of him, which marks an incredibly significant shift, it seems to me, in the history of the self in India. I was going to talk about that next time, but so you've got Guru Nanak, Chaitanya, and you've got Shiromani, whatever his name is in Nepal, in Bengal, talking about the category of the self. So you get a shift at that period in the notion of a self, where the self becomes disembedded from state, if you like. It becomes more individualistic. So that's all behind this. And I suppose fourthly, behind this is the notion of a history of ideas approach, that there's a journal, the Journal of Intellectual History now, which has been going for a few years. And I think that's a really interesting development. You can do a history of ideas in India, and you can do something akin to, say, you know, that Charles Taylor book, Sources of the Self, incredible history of the category of the self in the West, from the Greeks through to the modern period. You can do that kind of history in India, although that was disparaged in, you know, 19th century, or kind of timeless India, notions of the self are fixed and so on. But I suspect there can be a history of the category of the person and the category of the self within an Indian context. So that's what I've just said is behind this kind of project, if you like. So today I wanted to share with you a few thoughts, preliminary thoughts, about this dichotomy between the sacrificial self, if you like, and the renunciate self. And they're two sides of the same coin, seems to me. And there's a kind of dialogue, or I suppose there's a tension between the two running through this history. And the sacrificial self carries on, but it goes underground. It becomes divorced from the state apparatus because of the history. I'm not sure about South India, to what extent the Hindu kingdoms carried on. Vijayanagara, were they still performing sacrifices? I don't know. I have to find out. So, as I said, this is very early days. Today I want to talk about the Mimamsa view. Some of this may be repeating something I said at a previous lecture, and then I secondly want to talk a bit about the Vedanta view. I'm not going to read through all of this handout, but you can go through it by yourself a bit. But the So let's look at the Mimamsa. The Mimamsa is a sacrificial conception of the self. It's exciting and interesting because we often associate the history of Indian thinking with the Atmanic Vedantic view, but maybe it's the Mimamsa. Oh, yeah. So the Mimamsaka conception of the self. The Mimamsas thought, okay, there are two features of human reality. What is a human being? Which is arguably one of the fundamental questions of these early philosophies. And, okay, two features of what we are stand out for the Mimamsakas, that we speak and we act. We're speaking beings and we're acting beings. We move through the world, we act. These are the most important features of what a person is, what a human being is. And they consistently maintained a realist view. There is language, there is action, and there are things. So action, language, and things. Action has consequence in the world in the way that cognition doesn't. So also they're reacting against the Vedantins' emphasis on cognition. So action has consequence in the world. But thinking doesn't necessarily have consequence in the world. It's only when it's translated into action. It's the ritual performance, namely sacrifice, that takes centre stage of human activity. And we must perform such acts because, why? Because scripture tells us to do it. And there are other reasons too, like heaven at death. Even prior to other reasons such as going to heaven, or ensuring that the sun will rise tomorrow. There are passages in the Brahmanas that suggest that Vedic sacrifice was to ensure the continuance of the cosmos, the rising of the sun in the morning. I don't know. I have looked up those references, but a long time ago now. So anyway, the Mimamsa then is primarily reflection upon the language of scriptures, and that's reflection on the nature of action, which is enjoined by scriptures. So scripture tells us to do things, do this and don't do that. And then so Mimamsa is reflection on what that means, to do this and not do that, really. Thus, the relation between language, especially injunctions, and the world is of great concern. So theirs is a realist theory of meaning, but one which the relation between an expression and the external object for which it stands is not necessarily direct, but mediated through a generality. So for Kumarila, the order at the bottom of this page now is a quote here that I've got. Bring a cow, and that is an instruction to bring any individual belonging to the species rather than to bring a particular cow. But this order refers via the generality, samanya, so as not to indicate a particular cow or to indicate all cows. But the meaning is determined by the kind of thing that it's meant. So you've got this view, so they're analysing the way language refers to world and the way language is effective on action, the way it causes us to act in certain ways and the way it can do that. And it can do that through notions like bring a cow. That has meaning because of the generality, bring a cow. It doesn't mean bring that cow or bring all cows, but bring a cow. So that will affect our way we act in the world. And so they thought that what needs to be determined is the syntactic class to which statements belong. And so this is established by the nature of world in order to make sense. So, for example, bring Devadatta's cow, if it's a genuine sentence and not fictional, is an order referring to a particular arrangement in the universe or a particular state of affairs. So the world determines the meaning of our statements. This is the analysis of the way we interact with the world. And although it does acknowledge the notion of the invisible, the adrishta, the Mimamsa is particularly concerned with the visible, the drishta, and transactional human life. One of the main philosophers of Mimamsa is Shabara, who writes, in the human world, action is determined by things. It is not determined by words. As is the object, so is the action, not as is the word. So this is very interesting, I think. Although language is important, it's the objective order of reality that determines the kind of language that you have and the way that you act in the world. As is the object, so is the action. But in the divine realm, the object is known only through the word, he says, just as the way action is established. Therefore, an action is to be done only through one possessing knowledge of scriptural injunction. So all those things determine our... what's that noise? My phone, sorry. All those things determine action to some extent. If we want to act correctly, we have to act in accordance with scripture. So I thought that was a clear statement. You've got the Sanskrit there in the footnotes, about the nature of world and human life. So the characteristic of the lakshana of an action is through the thing rather than through language or the word. As is the object, so is the action. Things constrain human action, which is orientated towards them. So I suppose, the question the Mimamsakas are asking, what are the constraints that control an action into its particularity, into what it is? And they're saying the world, objective constraints in the world constrain our actions into their particularity. as well as injunction from Scripture. Now, the term thing that Shabara uses is arta, whose semantic ranging embraces not only thing or object, but purpose and meaning. And human action is orientated towards things, which can mean everyday objects. So in this passage, we see that in Vedic action, language is prior, and the thing is known through word. Here, thing refers to objects required for sacrifice. And so the directionality that controls human life is from impersonal revelation that demands human action, that in turn acts upon things, the things of the sacrifice, to achieve a purpose and telos of revelation. So there's another quote, in the divine realm, probably, just referring to that earlier quotation, in the divine realm, probably refers to the realm of revelation, of divine language, although it could be taken more literally as the realm of the gods, impermanent, but visible objects come into contact with permanent, invisible self, which in the case of Vedic injunction are determined according to their serviceability. So sacrifice in the visible world of life leads to heaven in the invisible world beyond life, and it is the visible act that points to invisible power of revelation, invisible power of action, and invisible heaven for the patron of the sacrifice. So, for Shabara, the sacrifice is not useless because it brings about heaven, although the primary reason for its performance is injunction. This is legitimate, if secondary, purpose. Another quote here. Thus, in order not to consider the sacrifice as useless, the achievability of heaven is understood. And as the effort of a person is constrained by the sacrifice, so the sacrifice should be his means. Therefore, it is well said that the sacrifice is a secondary quality and heaven the primary quality. So sacrifice is not without purpose, and Shabara admits that heaven is a telos of the rite. And so sacrifice is a link between these worlds. Another word that they use a lot is dharma. Dharma means that we must act in conformity with the law of Scripture, and the key point about it is that Scripture tells us what to do and what not to do. Scripture is injunction, vidhi, and scriptural statements can be divided into those that are direct orders and those that are simply a comment on, simply to commend injunctions, the Artavada. You know all this, I'm sure. So I won't go through all of this, but interesting, a later compendium of the Mimamsa that Jim Benson edited and translated, Mahadeva Vedantin's ritual manual, is concerned with, the other thing about this is it seems to be concerned with precise details of action, of ritual. So we've had this in the Nature Tantra, how many angulas, how many lengths is the ritual spoon, and they're so concerned about these small details of ritual actions. And this is all coming from this kind of world, if you like. So the scriptural injunction that a priest paid for by the patron should sacrifice a cow entails that he does not sacrifice a goat. So the passage in the text reads, at the statement he should offer, i.e. kill, a milch cow for Dyava Prithvi, a calf for the Maruts, and a bull for Indra, etc., the words Denu, etc., denote respectively an animal that has recently given birth, a young animal, and a male animal. And so the goat is not blocked, i.e. one possibility is that you can offer a goat instead of a cow. But it's saying, no, you can't. No, it says, because they denote these features only as occurring in a cow, and therefore would not operate properly without blocking the goat, and so the goat is blocked. So this text is full of these kinds of details. So in other words, you've got to be precise in the enactment of these ritual acts in the world, and that's what counts, that's what's important. So great attention to detail is given, great precision is needed, because we are defined by correct ritual action. And in such act, we reach our quintessential telos and place where the supermundane world that the text speaks from engages with the material world of human transactions. So the invisible supernatural world, if you like, touches the visible material world through these ritual actions. The ritual patron is the one who achieves the perfection of action in selfless sacrificial rite performed correctly. So it's not a matter of indifference which animal is sacrificed, but of concern, because it is important to carry out the precise injunctions of eternal scripture. So this kind of metaphysics highlights ritual act as having cosmic significance in its performance. Fritz Stahl, who was an Indologist of some years ago, but very interesting argument he puts forward, argued that Vedic sacrifice is about correct performance, action for its own sake and not for the sake of something else. So he posits the idea, what is an action? An action is for its own sake, or it's done for another reason, for the sake of something else. So he says Vedic ritual is action for its own sake, it's not for the sake of something else. That's what he argues. And that these other meanings associated with it are ad hoc and change through time. So ritual has a syntax for Stahl, a correct grammar, but no semantics. So all the ritual details that have to be correct, you can analyse into a syntax, but the semantics of it is of no consequence. And so ritual action is meaningless. So it's an important thesis, partly supported by the Mimamsa, that Stahl draws on. So the philosopher Kautsa, for example, claims that the Vedic gods expressed as mantras are simply names in the ritual process. They have no extra textual or extra linguistic reality for Kautsa, and mantras themselves are meaningless and artaka. So I think Stahl was inspired by Kautsa in his more general theory. So it is the structure of ritual that's important, and the ways in which mantras are embedded within each other rather than pointing to any meaning beyond themselves. Rituals are regularly structured activities distinct from interpretations of those activities. So if meaning is restricted to language, as Stahl thinks, then rituals are neither meaningful nor meaningless in a way, although meaning may be attributed to them as a secondary step. And Stahl's syntactic approach to ritual has been supported by other scholars in other fields, such as Meschel's applied this to Jewish sacrifice and pain to Japanese Buddhist ritual. And while we might accept Stahl's analysis of Vedic ritual into discrete forms of analysis, the inframing of ritual procedures, it does not necessarily mean that such ritual is totally meaningless. In demonstrating ritual structure and showing how meanings attached to ritual are minimized or even inconsequential, Stahl is showing how sacrifice is central and human meanings are not relevant. But it's a modern form of mimamsaka, in other words. It's a decentering of the human. I don't think I'll go through all my hand up, but the point is that the mimamsaka says that what we do, how we act kind of defines us, is most important. And there's within the Mimamsa, there's one view, like Shabra, that says, okay, heaven is a consequence of our ritual actions, but the main reason we do it is because of scriptural injunction. Kautsa later on comes and says, yes, that's all very well, but there's no inherent meaning to it. We do it because of injunction. But there's no inherent meaning to action and to ritual action, and the mantras that we use are without meaning, are meaningless, anartika. And Stahl picks up on that and develops that notion, pushes it to its kind of logical extreme in a way. So that raises questions about the category of the person or the self that I think is very interesting, because on the Mimamsaka view, it's not some passive inner Atman, some inner reality that is important, but it's the person in a social and political context in which we're acting, and the world has an impact upon us. We indirectly impact the world through ritual action. So it's that context which I think is that transactional context which is highlighted by the Mimamsakas, which is, I think, is a kind of insight that they have. And they see the threat to this world from the renunciate traditions that they challenge. And indeed, possibly, the I haven't read this yet, I don't know the Mimamsa well, but possibly they may have seen the renunciate traditions as undermining social mores or morality even. You know, these renouncers and just sort of scroungers off the stage and that sort of thing. But I don't know, haven't done enough work on it yet. So sacrifice then is important. The importance of sacrifice is linked to their notion of the self, and sacrifice is the model of worship. So on this view, that the later tradition of puja comes out of yajna. So this guy Lubin has argued convincingly that puja derives from the household rites of the smarter Brahmins, those who follow the secondary revelation or smriti, in contrast to the grand sacrifices of the Shrautas, who follow Shruti. And there's an interesting book by someone called Marco Ghezlani, Rites of the God King. And he argues for the continuity between the fire sacrifice and temple-based image worship through analysis of appeasement rites, shanti rites, to counteract inauspicious omens. And he argues that such appeasement rites emerge from the fourth Veda, the Atharva Veda, along with the science of astrology, another big field that has great impact on the medieval kingdoms. But the point is that sacrifice was central to state religion and the medieval kingdoms, a view supported by Lubin and Ghezlani's work, and as consequence for conceptions of self and person, primarily as a social actor, and the sacrificial model is one of affirmation of the social body, possibly through giving up what is dear to oneself, through sacrifice. I'll stop talking in 5 minutes or so. I won't go through the rest of it, I don't think, but I want to contrast that. So what I'm arguing is that you've got a mainstream sacrificial religion, state-sponsored, state-supported sacrificial religion. You've got its philosophical justification with the Mimamsa, and this entails a certain conception of the person not as a disembodied transcendent being, but as an embodied actor within a social and political context in which you must sacrifice because of injunction, because that's what the text tell you to do. Which is also a giving up of something. It's also a kind of renunciation. It's giving up, well, if you're the patron, it's giving up a lot of cash to do that. And it's giving up time. And it's subordinating your own desires to the Vedic injunction, to what you should and shouldn't do according to the Vedic injunction. In contrast, you've got the later Mimamsa or Vedanta, and it almost claims almost the exact opposite, that it's not scriptural sections of ritual that need primary consideration, but those of knowledge, because they reveal the true nature of the self and its relation to cosmic being. And this has been identified with the axial shift, you know, away from ritual to ethics. And by contrast, the Vedanta lays emphasis on salvation as a kind of knowledge. So it's not action that delivers redemption, but cognition. I mean, Shankara said you can meditate till you're blue in the face, but it's not going to get you liberation. It's cognition that gets you liberation. It's not action. So the primary intellectual object for the Vedanta is the self, and its ultimate foundation is the absolute. So in contrast to the Mimamsa, they're positing this self, which is Brahman, as ground, the metaphysical ground of being, of all appearances. which is really passive, and only one. And we've got various quotes. There's a halfway down that page six, you've got a quote. Brahman is the source of all things, and there was in the beginning, and was there in the at the beginning when everything was a unity, only one. And this is the foundational ground of all being, and even the social institution of caste, law, and sovereign power. And is the power that pervades the cosmos as sap pervades wood, salt, or water. You know this kind of language. And then so you get this quest for the what is the ground of being. In a sense, the Mimamsaka was too kind of too commonsensical, I think, for that kind of question, perhaps. So just going to concluding thoughts, you've got for the Vedanta, the ground of being is an absolute reality conceived monistically and later theistically, in contrast to the Mimamsa, which is non-theistic and does not problematize the existence of the world in the sense that it accepts the givenness of life. Like life is what we have, what we are given. And in contrast to the renunciatory traditions of Vedanta, Jainism and Buddhism, the Mimamsa affirms the value of sacred language as injunction embedded within everyday life, and furthermore affirms the value of ritual injunction and sacrifice and the power of sacrifice. So this philosophy preserves, if you like, a pre-axial way of thinking in privileging ritual over act, and privileging the actual performance of ritual over its internalization and over any claims to salvific knowledge. And by contrast, the Vedanta lays emphasis on salvation as a kind of knowledge, as a kind of cognition. It is not action that delivers us, but redemption, but cognition. So a number of reflections result from these descriptions that I've offered. I haven't gone through carefully, but if you're interested, you can read in your own time. First, the category of the person is not privileged as such, but is rather replaced with a metaphysical conception of self as undying, as the animating principle of the person. But while on the one hand the Mimamsaka is socially and politically relevant in privileging sacrifice and identifying concepts of person as acting and speaking, the Vedanta emphasis on renunciation focuses on cognition. Yet both are different kinds of decentering of the human, and both claim renunciation, either through sacrifice or through renunciation, leads to a higher reward, heaven or moksha. This is a bit speculative, but this is my initial thoughts anyway. So renunciation is the inverse of sacrifice, and we can read the history of thinking in these terms down to today, where sacrifice re-emerges as political and social ideal. But on the eve of modernity, new concepts of self emerge within philosophy and within devotional religion, as I was going to talk about next time. So I suppose, by way of summary, what am I trying to say? I'm picking up contradictions in some of this as I'm going through it, but you've got in Mimamsaka, you've got sacrifice as a social political reality as the main ritual activity of ancient India, which goes through to the medieval kingdoms, where it dies. But sacrifice carries on in local traditions, and it's preserved on the peripheries in Nepal, Bali and Kerala. And you've got the philosophical justification of ritual action in the Mimamsakas, which is a realist metaphysics, and in contrast to that, and that's reacting against the renunciate traditions of Buddhism and Jainism and the Shramanas. And then within the Vedanta itself, you get an internalization, you get an adoption of the renunciate traditions within the Brahmanical tradition with the Vedanta, which reacts against the sacrificial Mimamsaka world, if you like, by saying, the true sacrifice is the sacrifice of the self to the greater self, the internalization of the sacrifice. You breathe in the smoke of the fire And so you have these two competing world views, if you like, that that seem to go through the history of the of tradition. So that's about it. That's as far as I've got. So no one's throwing stones at me or eggs yet. So those are my initial thoughts for today's lecture. But it's just the beginning. And it might be wrong. It's a hypothesis about the sacrificial self.